What do the following films have in common? The Elephant Man, Of Human Bondage, Mask, and Scent of a Woman. You got it. They all feature characters with physical disabilities, and those are just a few titles from a very long list. Martin Norden is the author of The Cinema of Isolation, A History of Physical Disability in the Movies. He told Anne Strainchamps that people with physical disabilities have been in the movies from the beginning.
When the movies began in the late 1890s, up until about the World War II era, we're talking roughly a 40-year period, there were a number of stereotypes that began emerging about disabled people, and they tended to follow fairly rigid gender and age-related parameters, I guess you would call them. In the case of men, adult males who were disabled, they tended to fall into a stereotype that I call the obsessive avenger. And typically, it's a recently disabled male who becomes exceptionally embittered and relentlessly seeks revenge on the person, or in the case of Captain Ahab, the entity responsible for his disablement or some other moral code violation. And usually that character is dead by the end of the film. That's one extreme stereotype.
Are those characters usually the villains, or are they sometimes people we're sympathetic towards?
Yeah, almost always villains. Characters like Captain Hook, for example, who there was actually a silent era film version of Peter Pan that came out, I think, in 1928, and it had this very obsessive kind of character who just relentlessly seeks revenge on Peter Pan and so on. What's interesting, though, is that in the case of women and children, they were portrayed in a very different way if they had disabilities. It's the opposite end of the stereotype spectrum, what I call the sweet innocent. It's the character who is perfect in every way, except for the disability. I mean, the person might be sweet and pure and godly and virginal and exceptionally pitiable, and like the Tiny Tim kind of character from Dickens' A Christmas Carol. That kind of image found its way into many movies of the time. And in the case of women, there was a stage play that was really popular during the 19th century called The Two Orphans. And it became the basis for at least 7 or 8 silent era movies about two young women, one of whom is blind, and they spend so much time trying to find a cure for her. And maybe the most famous movie adaptation of that story was made in 1921 by D.W. Griffith, who is far better known for Birth of a Nation, but he also made a movie called Orphans of the Storm, which was based on The Two Orphans. And the message seemed to be, in these kind of movies, if you're a good character, you'll be rewarded with a miracle cure. It's an image that Charlie Chaplin worked with in perhaps his most famous movie ever, a movie called City Lights that he made in 1931. There's a young woman who is blind, and she's a flower seller. And the tramp character that Chaplin typically played in his movies, here in this movie, spends most of his time trying to raise money for a cure for her. So the message seemed to be, if you're a bad disabled person, you deserve to be removed. You'll be dead by the end of the story. But if you're a good disabled person, you'll be rewarded with this miraculous cure, and you'll be restored to the ranks of the able-bodied. A really unsettling set of messages that I think filmmakers were sending to people back then.
I want to talk specifically about a few different movies. One of the most disturbing ever made, you point out in your book, was Todd Browning's Freaks.
Yes.
I think it came out in early 1930s.
Yes.
And unlike a lot of movies, Freaks featured people with real life, real mental and physical disabilities. Can you tell me about that movie?
Sure. What's disturbing about this film is that, on the one hand, it tends to show the disabled performers in a favorable light. There's like a nice community of these people, and they interact well with each other as well as with their able-bodied peers. But by the end of the movie, they basically turn out to be a collective obsessive avenger. I mean, and again, you have to remember, this movie was directed by Todd Browning, who was a prominent figure among movie directors during the silent era. I mean, he was very big on the idea of developing this obsessive avenger character. And here we have an entire colony of obsessive avengers who seek revenge on a couple of able-bodied performers who had attempted to bilk one of their disabled cohorts out of an inheritance. And so it becomes this rather grisly revenge story at the end, and it really starts to follow that pattern of the obsessive avenger. And it really wasn't until the latter part of the 30s and into the 1940s where we began to see more positive image of disabled people. And I think a lot of that had to do with the returning veterans.
We're talking Why would that lead to more positive portrayals of people with disabilities?
Because here are people who made, major sacrifices on behalf of their countries and deserve to be held up in high regard. I mean, my guess would be that's the case. I mean, I've seen maybe one or two movies that showed a disabled veteran in a negative light, but the vast majority of them, whether it be from the World War II era or the Vietnam era, tended to show these veterans in a very favorable light for the most part.
In your book, you write, seems like one of the films you really like from that World War II era is The Best Years of Our Lives.
Yes. First of all, it's one of the rare movies to feature an actual disabled performer in the film. It was an actor named Harold Russell.
Wilma phoned.
Wilma? What does she want?
You.
Why can't they leave a guy alone?
Because they're fond of you, that's why. What made you leave the house and get them all worried?
Oh, they got me nervous.
How?
Butch, it's nothing. I don't want to talk about it.
How'd they get you nervous?
Well, they keep staring at these hooks, or else they keep staring away from them.
You mean whatever they do is wrong?
Why don't they understand that all I want is to be treated like everybody else? Take Pop, for instance. He was cleaning his pipe like I've seen him do a million times. And all of a sudden he got conscious that he had hands and I didn't, and he stopped cleaning his pipe and he tried to hide his hands like he was guilty or something.
Give him time, kid. They'll catch on.
I guess the only thing that bothers me a bit about The Best Years of Our Lives is that his character is shown to be relatively helpless when it comes to getting ready for bed and just doing ordinary everyday things, where I think the filmmakers are trying to make the point that he really needs this other person. He needs a spouse to help him make it through life. In actual life, Harold Russell was very self-sufficient and could do lots and lots of things by himself. But the filmmakers, I mean, they felt that was the wrong message to send, I guess, at that time. And they felt it was really important to establish this other person in Harold's life who could work with him and help him achieve fulfillment or whatever.
When I think of movies portraying vets coming to terms with some kind of disability, the one that really comes to my mind is Coming Home. What did you think of that one?
It's one of those movies that has some extremely good sides to it and some not so good sides to it. For starters, it's one of the very first films that I can think of that deals with ordinary, everyday issues of access and transportation. For example, there's a scene where Luke Martin, who's the character played by John Voight, he's a wheelchair-using veteran of Vietnam. He's been invited over to the home of Sally Hyde, I think her name is, played by
Jane Fonda. Yeah.
And she's invited him over, but her apartment or her home doesn't have a ramp. And so the film actually shows him getting up out of his chair and having to kind of scoot backwards, sitting down up the steps, and it's a very ordinary moment, but it's also a very extraordinary moment too, because that's hardly ever shown in the movies, just ordinary everyday problems of access that disabled people face, constantly.
Well, it also broke a kind of barrier in terms of being real, in that it was one of the first, or maybe the first, to admit that people with disabilities actually have sex lives.
Yes.
Do you know that when I dream, I'm not in the chair. I don't even have a chair in my dream. I have legs. When I was a kid, I used to jump in my mother's kitchen and touch the ceiling. She used to get pissed off because I'd leave my handprints on the ceiling,
Right.
I still check the snow reports, the conditions at Mammoth, I'm still the same person. You know? It's funny. People look at me, they see something else, but they don't see who I am.
I think people have a real hard time seeing who other people really are. People don't see me like I really am. People look at me, I think, and they see, oh, cheery Sally, the captain's wife. Sometimes I feel like I'm becoming what people see.
You know, I spend 95% of my time at the hospital thinking about making love with you.
I've never been unfaithful to my husband.
This is one of the first films that I can think of that portrays a disabled person as a sexual being. I think one of the stereotypes of disabled people is that they are sexless, or the opposite extreme, that they're filled with these diseased lusts. You know, it's either one or the other. So this is one of the first, actually, to explore that topic. It really broke new ground.
One of the other really interesting issues, I think, that you raise in your book is the fact that over the years, so many physically disabled characters have been played by able-bodied actors.
Yes.
You know, as though there weren't any physically disabled actors around who were able to portray characters. Is that still the case?
Unfortunately, yes, it is still the case. And sad to say, I think for a number of Hollywood actors, it's kind of seen as a way of getting Oscar nominations. I mean, there have been a number of able-bodied actors over the years who have won Oscars playing disabled characters. I mean, John Voight did so with Coming Home. Al Pacino won an Oscar for playing a blinded Vietnam soldier in...
Scent of a Woman.
Scent of a Woman, back, I think, in 1992. Daniel Day-Lewis won an Oscar, I believe, in 1989 for his role in My Left Foot, where he was playing the Irish poet Christy Brown, who had cerebral palsy. And one of Day-Lewis's competitors that year was Tom Cruise, who was playing the wheelchair using Ron Kovic from Born on the 4th of July. So we have dueling wheelchairs that year or something.
So why do you think filmmakers have so much trouble getting past these very basic stereotypes that you've been laying out? I mean, it seems like over and over again, the same kind of stereotypes and the same sort of plots have been with us from the beginning of movies.
Yeah.
How come?
It's really difficult to say. I mean, I think part of it, and this is just a simplistic kind of an answer, but I think in some ways they're lazy. I mean, they sometimes filmmakers rely very heavily on literary documents from the past. And these are the kind of messages that novelists and playwrights have been pushing across for centuries. And sometimes filmmakers just kind of pick them up and don't really question them.
The filmmakers and the films really are simply reflecting larger cultural attitudes. And it's because as a culture in general, we have very limited ways in which we understand and perceive people with disabilities.
Oh, I think so. I mean, that whole notion of someone overcoming a disability, I mean, that is so deeply ingrained in our society, and you still see it all the time, like someone who's physically challenged, you know, that kind of language. You know, even journalists today, when they refer sometimes to people with disabilities, they talk about a person who's challenged and is trying to make this heroic comeback and so on. And it implies that if you don't try to return to the ranks of the able-bodied or whatever, that you're a failure, you know. And I think that's what a lot of disabled people find so disturbing about some of these images, is that, like, here's an example. In the case of the movie on FDR's early adult life called Sunrise at Campobello, this is, you know, well before he became president, the movie concludes, and this is after he's contracted polio and has to use a wheelchair and so on, the movie concludes with him addressing, I believe it's the 1928 Democratic National Convention, and they show him getting up out of his wheelchair and taking 10 long, lonely steps to the podium to make his speech. And the movie concludes at that moment. We don't even hear him give the speech. It all focuses on his ability to get up out of the chair and walk those 10 steps. And the implication is, now he's returned, you know, however superficially, now he's returned to the ranks of the able-bodied. Now he's made his triumph.
Martin Norden is the author of The Cinema of Isolation, A History of Physical Disability in the Movies. He talked with N. Strange Champs.